welcome to The Logstat, the Army's premier podcast on all things sustainment, where we analyze new developments, discuss current trends, and forge the path ahead for the next generation of sustainment soldiers. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Logstat. I'm your host, Captain Garrett Pyle. Before we get into today's episode, I'd like to announce that the podcast is officially 1 year old. Last year, on February 18th, 2025, we launched the podcast with a teaser episode where I outlined the intent for the podcast and how the Army Sustainment was developing to meet you, the sustainment community, where you are, and deliver the most cutting-edge dialogue. Now, the first official episode didn't publish until a month later in March, but wow, what an amazing year that has been. This is the 40th official episode. Can you believe it? I mean, time really does fly by. And speaking of flying, in today's episode, we'll be discussing the aerial delivery programs and a concept known as Joint Forcible Entry, or JFE for short. Specifically, we'll be analyzing sustainment at the JFE. I know I'm looking forward to this discussion myself, as I've never been part of an airborne operation before, but the guests I have with me today have decades of combined experience to share with us all. So, without any further ado, let's dive in. My first guest that I have with me today is Lieutenant Colonel Jason Day, who is a native of Fayetteville, North Carolina. He was commissioned in 2007 as a transportation officer from Christopher Newport University, where he earned a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. His previous assignments include Germany, JBLM, Fort Bragg, the Pentagon, Fort Campbell, and the U.S. Southern Command with deployments to Afghanistan. He has earned his Master Parachute and Pathfinder badge and is Ranger qualified. He also holds a Bachelor's of Business Administration from Ohio University and a Master's in Military Studies from the Marine Corps University. He currently serves as commander of the 407th Light Support Battalion, 2nd Mobile Brigade Combat Team, 82nd Airborne Division. Welcome, sir.
Hey, Garrett, I really appreciate you guys hosting this. Looking forward to the discussion and how we do the Joint Forcible Entry down here in the 82nd Airborne Division. Super pumped. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. And next, we have Command Sergeant Major Louis Colon, who is a native of Puerto Rico and joined the Army in 2004. He's a 92 Zulu senior logistician. His previous assignments include Fort Lee, Fort Carson, JBLM, and Fort Bragg, with deployments to Iraq, the Philippines, Afghanistan, and Kuwait. He holds an Associate's in Arts from Pierce College, a Bachelor's in Supply Chain Management from the University of Arizona Global Campus, and a Master's in Leadership Studies from the University of Texas at El Paso. He also earned his Master Parachute Badge, and he currently serves as the Command Sergeant Major of the 407th Light Support Battalion, 2nd Mobile Brigade Combat Team, 82nd Airborne Division. Welcome, Sergeant Major.
Airborne all the way, teammates. I'm fired up to be here and talk the role of the NCO in the JFE.
Thank you very much. And our last guest we have with us today is Captain Zachary Stefanski, who's a native of Chicago, Illinois. He was commissioned in 2018 as a transportation officer from the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he earned a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. His previous assignments include Camp Casey, South Korea, Fort Campbell, and Fort Bragg. He's earned his parachute badge and completed aerial delivery and material officers course and jumpmaster course. After serving as the Hotel Forward Support Company commander in the 2nd Battalion, 325th Airborne Infantry Regiment, 2nd Brigade Combat Team, 82nd Airborne Division, he has just completed 1 year as a battalion operations officer in the 407th Light Support Battalion, 2nd Mobile Brigade Combat Team, 82nd Airborne Division. Welcome, Zach.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Excited to be here. Can't wait to get into it.
Just once again, I'm really excited to have you all on the show today. We have just so many years of experience from each of you to go over when it comes to aerial delivery operations of the JFE. So this is something new for me. So I'm excited to really learn from all the wisdom that you guys have. But first, before we even get into like how sustainment happens at the JFE, I know myself, and there's going to be a lot of others in the audience who are going to be like, what is it like? What is the JFE, and like, why does it matter to us as sustainers? So I'll turn it over to you, sir.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to hit you with doctrine right up front, and we'll unpack it from there. But really, from the Joint Pub 3-18, A joint forcible entry operation is executed to seize territory, and if required, to establish a lodgment against an enemy or force access into a denied area in order to establish maneuver and movement, right? And, you know, as sustainers, I think we really need to hone in on some of that definition and really the part of the establish the lodgment task in there, right? You know, because a lodgment is a designated area, you know, from airhead, a landing zone, a beachhead, or a combination of both, that affords, you know, the continuous landing of troops and material, right? So thus creating the foundation for an operation on the ground, right? And that provides the freedom of maneuver for the commander, right? You know, in my opinion, as an LSB commander and having been in four airborne units and the 101st and practiced multiple JFEs, right? The movement of personnel and equipment and supplies to support an operation like a JFE is solely a sustainment task, right? You know, I don't need or want infantry battalion commanders or my MBCT commander wondering how we're building combat power. And I want them thinking how we break out to follow on objectives or getting off the allotment piece. You know, as a sustainer, the movement control and the buildup of combat power is my task, right? I'm there to provide options and answers to my MBCT commander based on what I know at that point, right? You know, I'm going to hit you with kind of a military quote, and I believe it's relevant to like a JFE, right? And that actually from a Navy admiral. So, you know, apologize, go Army, be Navy. A sound logistics plan is the foundation upon which a war operation like a JFE should be based. If the necessary minimum of logistics support cannot be given to the combatant forces involved, the operation may fail or best only be partially successful. So, you know, that hits the JFE right on the head. If we cannot set the sustainment conditions prior to the JFE to ensure everyone has everything they need, or we can't build combat power on the opposite end, and once the JFE has been executed, you know, we will culminate within 48 to 72 hours, right? And that's why it matters to us as sustainers. So thanks.
So one thing I just thought of is, so now you're a light support battalion. Has anything major changed because of TIC now becoming a light support battalion when it comes to JFE?
Yeah. So, you know, from the RSTRUC, Army structural changes have happened to us. So, you know, we, you know, 8 months ago when we went to JRTC in 25-05, we were a BSB. So now we are a light support battalion, and we have, you know, our old distro company, our Alpha, has merged now with our headquarters company. Now it's a HDC. So we've had some structural changes inside our formation. And then we've also some paid parachutist positions within the LSB have gone away. So we are working through those now, you know, during our cycles now and up into our training cycle, how we unpack that and move forward.
In this conversation today, to see how, you know, you've went from a BSB, now you're an LSB, and just to see how those have affected you. Because I know this next point is like, so really, how do you even train for a JFE?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what we say here in gold in the 407th LSB is reps and sets, right? So when we're in our training cycle or training weeks, what we call P1s, right? When it's time to camo up and go do hard things, we're always saying reps and sets. So you'll hear that down the hallways here in gold. So, you know, from my standpoint, looking at a JFE training, you know, I look at it as, are our troopers confident in themselves by technical and tactical means? Are we ready to marshal our combat power as an LSB at an embarkation site, so at a arrival departure airfield control group, otherwise known as like an ADAG? Are we able to stage at a seaport staging area? Can we, you know, go to marshaling yards or tactical assembly areas and stage our combat power? Can we execute movement from there to the intermediate staging base, the ISB, and land at the established lodgment site or the tactical training areas and start building combat power, establishing C2s, right? From a goal standpoint, we kind of focus really on four block training events leading up to the JFE, right? So one large group right up front before we get into company operations, right? From individual side, you know, training such as, you know, E3B, right? Individual trooper proficiency, training and certifying our leaders, which is the qualification schools, et cetera, leaders times training, you know, taking our garrison tasks that we have and turning them into operations for our squads and platoons. So we call them dual purpose methods here. And all those small things are building confidence in our troopers and their ability to lead during a JFE operation, right? And then we get into our company FTXs, what we call Golden Spear One. Those are usually like 3 to 4 day operations where company commanders are issuing op orders, and platoon leaders, platoon sergeants are starting to work their troop leading procedures. This gives the company command teams the ability to marshal their formations, uncoil them out of their motor pools out to the field, and start working on company middle tasks and really deploying all their equipment, which is really confirming or denying their true readiness levels, and then massing their combat power and testing their C2 structure. And then really moving into the battalion FTX, which we call Golden Spear 2. We actually have one of those coming up here in about a week. We've issued a battalion op order to the company command teams. These are usually 8 to 9 day FTXs where we deploy and uncoil the entire battalion west of Gruber into our training areas. Again, another opportunity for marshaling our combat power and mass and synchronizing the movement and uncoil the battalion by time and space. You know, we're really, you know, obviously we're focused on battalion METs, and really typically Sergeant Major and I have 3 to 4 days worth of battalion requirements for the companies. And the remaining time is devoted to the re-attack on training from the company FTXs for the NCOs, right? And training events covered during these can be wide range, right? So we can do airdrop operation, pathfinder operations, sling load training, convoy operations, breakpoint operations for supplies for our SSA or field fielding for that, recovery and BDAR training for our maintainers, FARP or wet wing defuel, and then our weapons densities. All of those are JFE related in some capacity. And then we move into what we call the Avalanche series here in the 82nd Airborne Division. It's our brigade collective training events. It's another FTX where the entire brigade deploys west of Gruber into the training area. And that's like from an airdrop option, that is the joint forcible entry, where we execute air lands after that on the FLS. And we start to build combat power at the airhead. And then we execute ground convoys from garrison, another opportunity for the battalion and companies to mass the C2 power as it flows in, right? And then we really arrive at JRTC, right? That's the force on force where we execute a joint forcible entry again from a rep and set standpoint, right? These company command teams, battalion, you know, we've deployed our CP 3 to 4 times now before we get to JRTC. You know, platoon leaders executed, you know, dozens of marshaling operations and convoy operations. Our squad leaders, our team leaders have prepared our troopers for outload multiple times and executed PCIs, PCCs, and rehearsals dozens of times for the JFE leading up to it. So, you know, from a rep and stat standpoint, from the 407th, that's how really we deep down inside we get ready for a JFE.
I say, wow, sir, that is what you I would look at as very deliberate training set. That's you can truly see, especially from your results, how it sets you up for success. You know, going from the individual all the way up through each of the different levels. So, and now as you, I know you kept saying reps and sets, and I know there's a lot of importance with that because that's how you build your mastery. So. Sergeant Major, can you tell us more about that importance of reps and sets at the home station to prepare for the mission?
No, absolutely. As you heard a commander kind of talk, you know, there's always a buildup all the way up to JRTC, and we deploy multiple times in that buildup, that train up that we're given. So, you know, from my perspective, reps and sets at home station, they're non-negotiable, right? The JFE is chaotic. We all know combat is chaotic, so people, you know, soldiers, paratroopers will fall back into what they rehearse, right? So that's where that reps and sets, you know, the another way that Sergeant Major has probably said this before in the past is to do it again, right? Do it again, be brilliant at the basics. And that's something that we stick to here in Gold. And I'll give you a couple examples, right? So like for Multiple Mondays, we try to operationalize everything, right? So it's not just a vehicle rollout, you know, for multiple UPMCS, the weapon is a set and rep for the platoon sergeants, platoon leaders to get out there and do some command and control, you know, some movement, some dispersion as they operationalize Multiple Mondays, you know, and I use another example here in Gold, right? So for medical, right? Medical is huge, especially in LISCO. And if we don't self-aid or buddy aid, then it just sets our paratroopers up for failure. So, you know, during PT, something as simple as when we do sergeant's time PT on our Wednesdays, that's what we dictate. We do self and buddy aid, right? So after they get done doing some combat focused PT, they rehearse, you know, casualty response, right? And they treat each other and they get another set and another rep in that.
So I think everything you're just talking about, I mean, we can apply that whole mindset to anything. You know, not just course here, as we're talking about right now, of course, the JFE, but this concept of reps and sets and how you're deliberately doing it throughout the week can be applied across any different, any formation. Like you talked about, like if you're doing PT, you can be doing combat focused PT. So you're getting after, hey, I got to get some medical training done, or I got to do X, Y, and Z, like utilize your time, you know, efficiently. And the key to all this is the NCO Corps. So how do we certify our NCOs for JFE?
So I'll jump on that one, sir. And here in Gold, I was actually able to do a 3-day training event called Talon Forge. It's what I call it. It's an NCO LPD. You'll find sergeants at all levels that may know more than the staff sergeants, or, you know, they grew up in different areas. This 3-day event, you know, focus on three things, right? Lethality, teamwork, and then building the legacy. So that's one way, you know, bringing all the NCOs together and building a baseline for knowledge, right? They have to be competent and they have to be confident in their skill, right, as an NCO. And that's something that that we do here in Gold, right? Not only does that, but it provides a shared understanding amongst the NCO Corps here in Gold.
Perfect, because, you know, as we all know, the saying always goes, the NCOs are the backbone of the Army. That is so true. So just seeing how your team is able to certify them to ensure that operations run smoothly on the ground is awesome. So I kind of want to transition the conversation a little bit, but just kind of focus on, like, does your team have like an aerial delivery program for the JFE? Like, how does that operate? Zach, can you kind of walk us through that a little more?
Yeah. So in short, yes, the LSP, we have a fairly strong aerial delivery program that we, you know, like to train on regularly, you know, to get those reps and sets in. Just to highlight some of the successes that, you know, we've been able to have over the course of the program is, you know, one, during our brigade FTX Avalanche series, you know, we were able to run the PZ control for one of the rifle battalions as they're conducting the initial assault, air assault as part of the JFE, and then continue that, you know, throughout the duration of the exercise, you know, leveraging sling loads and LCLAs as a part of our overall sustainment plan. Additionally, you know, during our JRTC 2505 rotation, you know, is taking lessons learned that, you know, that we had through previous training exercises. You know, we were able to, you know, we built 140 CDS dedicated for the Alpha and Bravo echelon for the JFE, with, you know, 40 being built at home station for Alpha echelon, and then an additional 100 being built during RSOI over a 3.5-day period, you know, that we were able to leverage, as a part of our whole sustainment package for that. And more recently, you know, specific to the LSB, you know, we've been, you know, focusing a little bit more on transitioning over to expanding our operations over to heavy drop operations, you know, so we can, you know, increase our proficiency when we're, you know, opening contracts and operating with the heavy drop rigging facility and building more, you know, vehicle platforms or equipment platforms and gaining some proficiency on that side of the house. But to answer the second part of the question for specifically, like, how does it generally operate? So as a battalion, when we go out to the field tactically, we operate out of three base clusters that we call the Griffin nodes. And the intent overall for the aerial delivery program is for each one of those clusters to have the ability to set up a PZ or LZ site and be able to send and or receive commodities in any way, shape, or form that we're able to. So with that, you know, it takes us kind of the origins to the program is, like, in order to be able to accomplish that, we have to, you know, certify those clusters to be able to run those PZ and LZ sites. So about a year and a half ago is when the battalion started heavily investing into the program, which, you know, started with the first phase, which is, you know, initially certifying leaders to do that job, you know, i.e., you know, sending people to air assault school, you know, sling load inspectors certification course, otherwise known as SLIC, or ADMOC, which is the aerial delivery material officers course, and Pathfinder. So at the company level, you know, we were prioritizing, you know, sending the right people, and a large credit goes to the companies because, you know, during that initial period, as we were focusing on sending people to those schools, you know, we were able to get, you know, at least 20 people certified during that initial period. And then at the battalion level, you know, we were focusing heavily on developing our planning SOP. So as we were, you know, getting those people certified, we can go forth and, you know, actually execute some of those events. So after, you know, we get past the first phase of, initially certifying our leaders, you know, we moved on to, you know, then going into practical application, you know, getting the sets and reps that we need to become proficient at that. So, you know, we focused on, you know, training progression. So initially, you know, we had a really strong battalion air team that took the lead to help us build, you know, going from, you know, doing elevators with single point sling loads, controlling a single PZ site, you know, just prioritizing getting sling load teams comfortable underneath an aircraft, you know, to elevating that and, you know, controlling multiple PZ sites, you know, going from, you know, single point loads to dual point loads, you know, operating day under both day and night conditions, and you know, integrating, you know, larger complex situations into what we're doing, and, you know, focusing on getting repetitions and how we can add new layers to build our proficiency. And a large part of that, of adding those layers, you know, was, you know, conducting thorough AARs and capturing our lessons learned, so we can, you know, integrate those into our SOPs as we're progressing that complexity as well.
Yeah, I mean, Gary, I gotta jump in on this one because I'm obviously passionate about our program here. You know, there's, as Zach mentioned, there's an investment here that you have to do up front, right? Is it taxing? Yes. But to build a proficient and safe air delivery program, you gotta invest hard and you gotta invest early. That's from planning, resourcing, like schools and certifications that need to be done, right? And I, you know, while I got everybody on the net, I mean, I got to give a shout out to the ADMOC and sling load certification course there at Fort Lee. They have been a huge part of our success and partnership that we built with them over the last 20 months, and huge credit for them and helping us down here at the FLOT. So, you know, as Zach had mentioned about CDS build, about 140 at for JRTC for our rotation on the JFE, right? You know, just some points from my stand from my foxhole on aero delivery, right? You know, CDS, you got to trust it. You got to prioritize it. And, you know, what we did, we dropped 44 CDS prior to our joint forcible entry and put it on the DZ before the troopers got there, right? It paid huge dividends for us. And, you know, the amount of water that we dropped on the drop zone prior to the JFE, so troopers had it on the ground, it lightened their loads as they were rigging, getting ready to load aircraft, right? So you got to trust it. You know, and another thing, you know, I got to emphasize, and it goes back to some of our principles of sustainment, right? Simplicity. Making CDS, containerized delivery system, right? It can't be a Burger King way. And not everybody can get their own thing, right? So for us and Gold, I dictated that there's only two categories of CDS, right? It's class one, water, a little bit of MREs, and then one type of ammo, right? If everyone has their own CDS, you're not going to find it at 03 in the morning on the drop zone when everybody's been up for several hours and are moving out at a fast pace to their tactical assembly areas. I mean, you could put a GPS on it. You can try all the collars you want, but at 03 and everybody's trying to move out, Murphy is just, it's going to be waiting for you. If you don't make it simple. Right. And another thing for us, you know, when we did the scatter plan of the CDS and how we did it, you know, I literally just put it out to the paratroopers, right? Don't be greedy on the drop zone, right? We're all part of one team. It was out there. It was a brigade collection site of all of this. Take what you need, not what you want. And if everybody does that and has the same mentality, it will work for you. I mean, we lived off CDS before the G-Locks opened up for 4 days because troopers, you know, had that discipline of take what you need, not what you want. So, you know, you got to trust it. So there you go for your delivery on this.
I can definitely see. So it wasn't like a free for all, everyone just running in there, filling up everything they want. Yeah. Just,
yeah. You got to make it simple for them. Right. And you got to lay to the ground rules for it. And if everybody adheres to it from private day to Lieutenant Colonel day, you'll be all right. You know, for the ammo piece, we dropped one type of ammo, 60 millimeter. That was it. We put, I think off the top of my head, maybe 700 rounds of 60 millimeter on the ground. So if a trooper ran up and saw mortar rounds, obviously he knew like that was only it, and then moved off to the next bundle, and then there was his water, right?
So with this, do you use rotary in your air delivery programs then?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, you know, I had a conversation with a good friend of mine, a pilot, former Talon 6, Don. You know, one of the most underutilized aspects in a CTC rotation when it comes to sustainment is rotary lift, right? You know, we leave so much blade time unused. It's horrible, right? So as sustainers, we got to put a shot of brain power into use of rotary lift for because you can build massive amount of combat power during a JFE with rotary lift if they're not being utilized. You know, as Zach talked about, you know, all the loads that you could put underneath, you could put some loads inside of CH-47, all that. You know, once fixed wing, you know, your C-130s, your C-17s are complete doing air land and they got to fly back and do crew rest. You know, the next thing smoking should be the rotary lift, bringing in combat power. You know, again, you have to synchronize that. It can be challenging, but you could build so much combat power in a JFE if you do that. I mean, you can dual shot gun ISVs underneath the CH-47. You can put A-22 cargo bags underneath the UH-60, right? So there's so many options out there that people just are not trained to do or don't plan it out, and we miss that opportunity to mass sustain combat power for our troopers during a JFE.
So one of the things that I was thinking of, you know, as we're talking about building that combat power, you know, how we're getting these loads on the DZ, I know there's a lot of new technology coming out right now. Is any of this new stuff, because you with drones and some new stuff with some of the autonomous capabilities, is that going to be changing how you do your operations at the JFE?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about, you know, what autonomous capability drones out there for sustainment packages are. I mean, I think I've seen some articles with Temp Mountain using the, I think, TRV-150s, I believe that's what it's called. You know, so there's options out there. We're looking at that. I think here over the next training cycle that we have coming up, we're going to start to incorporate some of those options into the delivery system. So, you know, as Zach talked about, you know, you've got the LCLA drops, the low cost, low altitude drops. We've got the CDS, the heavy drop. We've got the sling load. And then now we will probably add the UAS capability or the autonomous capability for sustainment. So we're super pumped about that as we start to unpack that here in the next training cycle.
That's what's so unique is that you've already been able to sit out here and test going from a BSB to an LSB. And now as we continue to go through TIG operations, just to see how we're testing out new pieces of equipment to see how we can that can help us make us more lethal across the battlefield. So it's just very interesting and just love to continue to, especially as you all test that out, just to see how that works out for you all.
Yeah.
And then I also know, like, looking at, like, how does your rigorous home station training, like, how does that directly translate to success at the, like, at a CTC rotation, specifically like the Joint Readiness Training Center or really anything operation for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I got kind of like three things for you on that one. I mean, because that's kind of very passionate, right? Realistic and tough training, right? You know, I learned this as a FSC commander in 2P and 3rd Brigade in the 82nd, right? Shout out to 2P, the best P. You know, the hard training, tough training, you know, it builds that scar tissue for the troopers out there, right? You know, we just executed about 14, 15 months ago. We had a goal in Spear 2 at Battalion FTX back in December of 2024. It was 8 days, and it was in 10 to 15 degree weather with wind chill that we fought through, and we took it, right? We executed the training. We built hardened scar tissue out there, but that really like builds bonds within the formation and building the resiliency and determination with our troopers that they can tackle hard stuff. You know, here, like I said, we're about to go out to the field here in about a week or so, you know, tracking the snowstorm coming in. So we're about to do it all over again. And like the troopers are pumped. They're just, again, down the hallway, reps and sets. You know, another thing that I harp here in the 407th LSB is coming out strong, right? And I think, you know, one of the most, and what I mean by that, like, I think one of the most important things a unit can do is come out strong when crossing the LD, right? Did we hit the SP right on time? Are our vehicles right order of march? PCIs, PCCs done to standard. We're not missing anything or anyone, right? Are comms loaded in our vehicles? Weapons mounted? Did the, you know, convoy briefs done to standard? And then are we hitting our checkpoints planned right on time? Are we arriving at our tactical assembly areas where we're supposed to be and when we're supposed to be, right? All that matters because, you're coming out confident because you're coming out with a win underneath your belt already if you do that right, and then you're ready to deal with whatever MetTC comes your way, right? It's very difficult, and I stress this enough with our troopers here. It's very difficult to regain the momentum when you come out all jacked up crossing the LD. And then Murphy's waiting there to hit you in your throat, and you haven't even set a good foundation for your operations yet. So I harp on that for all everybody here in Gold. And then additionally, you know, Officer Pacific, you know, I hold them very accountable for training. And what I mean by that is, have we gone above and beyond for our resources and tools needed for our NCOs to train our formations? Like, we do not half-cock any of our resources here in Gold. Like, we provide the most realistic, safe, and beneficial training to our troopers. Like, I hold the officers strictly accountable for that, for preparations, for training. That goes from resourcing, the orders production, right? Is it shared understanding across the formation? Do the NCOs know what they're accountable for out there in the training site? And then leadership, like being invested in what you're doing and believing in what you're doing, right? You do that, and then we hand that off to, you know, the command sergeant major, first sergeant, to platoon sergeants, and that they aggressively get after out there in the field. And execute that hard training.
It said Murphy's always waiting in the shadows.
Always.
He's out there just creeping, trying to get us. But, you know, I like just really like how you kind of walked us through that, and just like really how your team, you know, it's that rigorous training, but it really does set you up for success. And I know it comes down to what, you know, the final conditions check. So, Sergeant Major, can you kind of walk us through, like, what does your final conditions check involve to really get after that, like that final point of we're getting ready for mission success?
Yes, sir. And it's very simple. Commander covered it, right? With PCCs and PCIs, the NCOs, they lead that, right? They don't leave any stone unturned, right? They make sure that the PCCs, PCIs are conducted to standard. Another thing that we like to hit over here is personnel readiness. You know, are the paratroopers, are they medically clear, right? Are they properly equipped? Are they mentally ready? Is their families ready? That leader engagement, that one-on-one with that sergeant, right, is crucial, right? Is the equipment ready, right? So that's not only are you doing like a PCCs, PCIs on the paratrooper, but you also do it on the equipment, right? And then I really harp on the NCOs on this, for the soldiers as I do my battlefield circulation is, you know, mission readiness. Do the paratroopers know the plan? Do they understand the plan? Do they know where they are in time and space according to the face of the operation? So that's kind of like how we do that final conditions check.
Yeah. I'm going to hop in here. As Sergeant Major said, and hit it right on the head, right? I'm going to steal some verbiage from our old Sergeant Major, Brigade Sergeant Major Command, Sergeant Major Zalai Z, shout out to you. This is what I used to say, and it stuck with me, right? If you think you're micromanaging, then go ahead and add 20%, right? There are no implied tasks here. If you think there's, you know, implied tasks the way to go, you'll be sadly disappointed, right? Leaders need to trust but verify and really implement a way to confirm or deny subordinates understand what you are telling them. That could be the confirmation brief, back brief. That could be, you know, NCOs briefing the platoon sergeant to confirm or deny that PCIs, PCs have been done to standard. Again, you got to come out strong, and that it goes back to, you know, the leader checks. So thanks.
Now, thank you very much for that, sir. And I like that. I like that a lot. You know, just no implied tasks. You know, go out there, confirming everything is done right, especially for this type of operation where there's so many different moving pieces. We've walked through already, like, how, you know, what a JFE is, how you're getting through it, how you're training for it, and just these going through the rigorousness of these reps and sets. But let's look at it now on execution on the ground. We've kind of walked us through how we get there. So can you kind of tell us more about your experience, especially where key leaders are positioned for the execution phase?
Yeah, I mean, so this is how Command Sergeant Major and I fight, right? So I'll give you how we do business here in 407th, and it's shooter preference, right? So this is just a way. But for me, in the start of the joint forcible entry operations, like I go where I see the biggest friction being, right? So risk to mission, risk to force and thought process. And obviously I'm going to bounce that off my brigade commander for concurrence, but you know, that could be the departure airfield. That could be the marshalling area for the brigade's combat power. I could be executing the jump to beyond the DZ as we build combat power. So all those are options out there. But, you know, I'll just pull from our last rotation, right? We needed an O5 headquarters at the departure airfield, working with the Air Force entity to ensure, like, our brigade priorities for the priority vehicle listings and the combat power being enforced, and that my brigade commander could have, like, the commander-to-commander dialogue so he can get an assessment of the force flow of combat power into the DZ and ADAG and get my recommendations or hear anything from me that could impact the ground tactical plan at his level, right? You know, for Goal 9, he was with the bulk of the formation down at the battalion marshalling or the brigade marshalling yard, ensuring final conditions were being met. And he was moving the majority of the force with the first sergeants so we can cross LD when called, right? Again, other, you know, PCIs, PCCs, and our secondary loads and our vehicles and all that. Sergeant Major was leading that front, right? The SPO jumps, right? That's my field grade on the ground. I need the SPO on the ground during the JFE, in my opinion. You know, I'm a little biased, but I think being the SPO on the ground right after a jump and doing the initial stages of combat power build is like one of the most exciting and rewarding parts of being a SPO, right? The SPO is the coup ops, and he or she is the tactical sustainment arm for me during the JFE, right? It reports back to me as sustainment combat power is being collected or received at the Hammerhead and then across the DZ. The Battalion XO, right? You know, for our instance, for this one, he was with me at the ADAG and took over for me after the JFE. I think it was D+2. Once the initial armor and C2 and artillery got in, which was like our, you know, our top stuff, I gave it to the XO to run so I can move to the convoys and enter into the AO. And then once my XO closed out what we call the Bravo Echelon, the Airlands, with the Air Force, he caught the last flight into the box. Once on ground, the XO stayed with the staff with the main command post because I needed him driving the staff for the next phases of the operation so I could command. So sole purpose of the XO was to drive my staff so I can get out there. And then S3 Zach was with me everywhere. He was my rear seater. He was battle tracking the fight and providing me updates so I knew exactly what was going on all the time. So I had to, you know, the shared understanding piece.
Yeah, so I'll jump on that, sir, if you don't mind. So from the senior enlisted advisor to the commander, what I would say is, you know, be where your commander is not, right, to bring back that information that he or she needs. Be the eyes and ears of the commander. And we did that. You know, we synced up in the mornings and the afternoon, you know, and I would ask him, hey, what gives you anxiety? And I would go to that friction point and bring back that information that he needed at that time.
So I know you kind of touched on this, you know, a little bit, but who is responsible for the different sustainment tasks while you're out there?
Yeah, I mean, so maintaining, sustaining the flot, the four line of troops for the MBCT, and as the senior sustainer in the brigade, I'm responsible for all of it, right? Understanding the complexity of supplies and equipment replacements, moving from the rear to the front, right? And then our wounded, our KIA, our battle damaged equipment, you know, moving from the front to the rear, right? It is a complex environment and it's constant. And I am responsible as the senior sustainer in the MBCT for the continuous movement of combat power. Again, you know, sustaining and maintaining the brigade flight, again, my personal personal opinion is it's a logistician responsibility. Yeah, I want my brigade commander and fellow infantry commanders focused on the fight in front of them, like the T-90s coming down the avenue approach, right? Locating the enemy long-range fires that could land at our debarkation site or enemy formations about to hit the flot, right? That is, I want the maneuver figuring that out and I'll figure out the rest, right? And if my brigade commander or my peers are focused on the rear operations, then we're absolutely failing at our job, right? You know, and then the great debate that I've heard time and time again is the SPO and the brigade four, right? And this, again, this is my preference, right? How I see it, the SPO is responsible for the actions on, you know, that is the coup op fight, you know, fighting and sustaining or fighting and synchronizing the sustainment for the brigade. That is the SPO. The brigade four is the foo ops arm, right? It's thinking the deep fight, the next phase, fighting for resources at the division for me, setting conditions with the division for mobility, enforcing, you know, and also enforcing the brigade commander's sustainment priorities. So I know, right? You know, where they reside in the formation during the fight. Like, I think I heard, and maybe it was a couple of months ago, that I heard a podcast about the idea of the SPO sitting up with the brigade four, like shoulder to shoulder, right? You want my honest opinion? I think as a sustainment, you know, commander, I don't see that being feasible, right? You know, if I'm responsible for sustainment fight, the SPO will be with me so I can provide guidance, the direction at any given point. 100%, I think there should be a SPO LNO at the brigade, but the SPO actual needs to be under my span of control so I can understand and flex sustainment power anywhere I need to do it. So there you go.
Hey, well, I think we could probably just do a whole separate episode one day just talking about the S4 versus the SPO and how you utilize them and where they need to be at. So you just touched on something, sir. I think there'll be a great future episode one day.
100% agree. 100%.
So then I kind of look at how can you kind of, well, I'll ask you this to you, Zach, like how can you talk us through how sustainment is built prior to the JFE?
Yeah. So overall, I would say sustainment, you know, it's a brigade effort. And, you know, the biggest, you know, with that, the biggest challenge, you know, Army sustainment has is time. So, you know, while our sustainment infrastructure, you know, can be adaptable and efficient, you know, amassing combat power, you know, usually, you know, requires, you know, time. So, you know, we really have to, you know, understand that, you know, at the brigade level, sustainment operations, you know, begin prior to leaving home station, you know, both with, you know, planning and preparation, and then, you know, continuing that, you know, through RSOI. So quick examples, I have this, you know, be like, you know, if you look at like, you know, combat configured loads, CCLs, or, you know, building of CDS, you know, for our rotation as a brigade, you know, we began in planning and preparations, you know, the weeks, you know, leading up to, you know, well, our deployment down to Fort Jonathan. So before we even sending people down there, you know, we were discussing, you know, those things so that like, as soon as we had boots on the ground, you know, we could transition into, you know, rapidly building, you know, those, you know, CCLs and CDS, and we knew exactly how much we wanted to build, and we had the resources in place to be able to execute, you know, building those things. So generally overall, like, you know, I would say, you know, it starts with, you know, planning and preparation early, and then like as soon as you get on ground, rapid transition to executing.
So can you talk us through the possible friction points you see when building combat power?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, Murphy is always out there. So nothing ever goes 100% as planned, right? But I will say this, right? You know, it's all about asking the question, have we set the logistical foundation for ourselves before the first parachute goes over the drop zone so we can break out once we hit the ground on the JFE? Again, you know, my two favorite principles of sustainment, simplicity, survivability play a huge role here. I would say this, have we made it simple for Private Day on the ground running to his link up point to pick up and grab water via CDS on the drop zone before he gets to his alpha, as kind of we discussed earlier? Have we done the right priority vehicle listing where sustainment has been placed in order to offload so we can actually sustain the brigade? No, understanding the PVL has to be kind of a waterfall as to sustainment. Like you start small with the company trains and then you end big with the like the LSB bulk stuff. You know, again, understanding the PVL with the brigade commander's priorities, but as a sustainer, you got to have a voice on the table, right? Fighting for your capability because everybody wants some type of commodity to come or some type of combat power to come off. So the friction point there in the PVL, that could be a whole nother episode on the PVL fight. You know, once on ground, I see units struggle with this on the JFE, right? It's not usually a sustainment issue. There's commodities on the drop zone or building up at the ADAC following the JFE. It's how you distribute them to units that we have issues with, right? You know, Falcon 6 and I and my brigade commander discussed this as we got into our training cycle before going to JRTC, how to solve this. And again, I know this is not a doctrine term, and hopefully nobody at CASCOM will hit me up on this, but we had dedicated vehicles that collected the items from the DZ or ADAG and pushed it out to the infantry battalions in the first 72 hours to sustain weight. We called them rabbits here in the Falcon Brigade. But, you know, these can be vehicles that are dedicated during the heavy drops during the JFE, or it can be the first thing smoking off the air lands to help solve that distribution problem, like with a team sustain, you know. That is really, and again, that's why I want the SPO to jump and be there on the ground to help synchronize that whole piece. You know, again, it's all about helping units break out from the DZ. And again, that's setting conditions by the sustainers here, you know, for it. So You know, another area where I see units struggle in the JFE, right, is establishing class three operations, right? You know, the vehicles that you sling load or the vehicles that are coming off the air lands, you know, for us, you know, we had armor coming out. We had Bradleys from Third ID rolling off the C-17s. But again, they had limited fuel, you know, as part of the JI process, right? So how do you sustain armor or your dig assets that you dropped, you know, for the first 72, 96 hours before the G-locks, the ground lines of communication that have opened up, right? No enemy is going to leave a perfect grade fuel and bulk for us as we come into their airfield that we just took, right? So, you know, for us, what we did here in 407th and in the Falcon Brigade, you know, we looked at that and tried to figure that out. And we went to the option of the wet wing defuel, right? What that is where we fly our two fueler, our fuelers, our 978s, in a C2 package on a C-17 Globemaster 3. And as we do air lands post JFE, the parachute infill, these 978s roll off the C-17s back up to the aircraft. And then with the loadies and our fuelers hook up, and the C-17 dumps its hot fuel into our fuelers, and we cycle it, test it, make sure it's good. And then we immediately turn and we dump it into the armor, the dig assets that they have, bulk fuel. You know, that is huge, right? We did that for our rotation. I think we did it five times, day and night time conditions, right? So, you know, that it can be dicey, you know, doing it under nods at night, you know, builds that, again, reps and sets. You gotta do the crawl, walk, run. Like, so for us, our crawl, we did it on Pope Airfield, kind of just how we load the aircraft, how we back it up, you know, all these connections. And then the walk, we did it during our avalanche series of the Brigade CTE, where we flew a 978 in, you know, offloaded it, backed it up, did all that during daytime operations, and then hit the ground running at JRTC. And we were pumping fuel for the first 96 hours, no issues whatsoever. You know, I would tell you a quick story about like the survivability piece and the responsibility. You know, we had a brand new lieutenant show up, and it was the platoon leader for our fuel and water platoon. And I literally sat down with this lieutenant and said, hey, you know, the first 96 hours and the movement of our combat power solely rested on your shoulders and your team's survivability, right? Because the enemy is going to be looking for your 978s because they know that we don't have fuel on the ground. But again, armor is moving around, dig assets are continuing to go for 48, 72 hours, and they are wondering how we are maintaining that. So, our team, our lieutenant and platoon sergeant, you know, cover and concealment, right? The basics. Like, we were hiding our 978s into the wood line, covering them. We were hunting, putting them underneath overpasses so they couldn't be seen by any type of drones, right? And then only called them out when the aircraft landed and we could execute the wet wing and execute that within 20 minutes and get them back hidden, right? And then we fuel up the armor where we could. So, again, we got to be tactically about it because if we lose those, then it's going to make it extremely difficult. So that wraps it up there. Thanks.
So one thing I want to look at, sir, is talking about the rabbits. But that's, you said, like, oh, this is not a doctrinal tournament, but that's how we build doctrine though. That's how we find new ways, is from innovations from the field, from the units that are actually doing them. So who knows, is, you know, talk out the CASCOM, that, who knows, that might become a doctrinal turn one day because of the operations that your team is working right now.
Yeah, just let it be known, it came from, you know, 2 MBCT in the 82nd Airborne Division, the rabbit term.
So we'll coin that now.
Roger that.
But we've had a great conversation thus far today, like kind of walking through that. I know I'm learning a lot myself, just how this operation functions. I kind of like, as we, one of the last things to close out today is, from each of your experiences, what would you say are some top lessons learned from the JFE when it comes to sustainment operations? And I'll start with you, sir, and go down.
Yeah, sure. So I got four quick things, right? You know, and I'll throw it at this first, right? Maneuver commanders like to lead with HE, high explosive, on the objectives, right? So as a sustainer, one thing, you got to know your supply chain and large munitions, like where your 105s, where your 155s, charges, mortars, your 120s, your 81s, like that, we beat that into our battle rhythm, that like every morning, me, my FA battalion commander, Mike Monroe, good friend of mine, shout out to Mike, brigade commander, were synced on our large munitions. We knew where it was at all times, what was coming in, what we had on hand, and then what was down at the FSC. Not for me specifically, I didn't worry about what was at the gun line because I already thought that is already expended for my avenue. But, you know, the FA battalion commander and me synced at the hip on munitions, that is huge. So you just got to make sure you do that because commanders like to lead with HE and you never want to run out. And now, though, with, you know, the power of the commander's worksheet, and that is the initial guidance that you got to give your XO and S3. That helps drive the staff, answers their initial questions and assumptions, so they can go into MDMP with something, right? And that is, as a commander, that helped them drastically. I mean, I'm sure Zach could smile right now because we, you know, hand him that, and him and the XO hit the ground running. You know, another thing, a commander's perspective, you got to understand terrain management when it comes to the JFE. So as we talk about all these forces that are flowing in, either, you know, from the airdrops perspective, from the stuff coming off the C-17s, C-130s, where did they all go, right? So there's only so much usable terrain until you punch out in a JFE. And that's not really, I mean, that's not LSB's responsibility piece, right? But you got to be at the table to fight for where you need to go, right? So for as our major, I think Zach mentioned, like we have three clusters. So where do they all go? And I'm not landing on a PAA or I'm not landing on somebody else's, you know, frontline trays or whatever it is. The terrain management will bite you in the rear if you don't, you know, sit at the table and make sure everybody has a good shared understanding. And then I think, right, this is my opinion, right, commander-to-commander dialogue, like, especially during the CUB, I believe is one of the most important. SCUP, Log Cop, they're all important, play a vital role in planning and synchronizing sustainment. But I believe hearing what, you know, your fellow commanders, so if you're a CLC commander, hearing what your fellow captain commanders are going through, or what my boss's objectives or intent or priorities are, you know, as a tactical sustainer, we must understand really the ground tactical plan and what is happening real time. You know, I would listen and just take notes, and I would always go last because I want to hear everything that my fellow commanders were going through, and what they're about to go through in the future, right? That helps drive the sustainment aspect. Like I don't really need a log stat to tell me that my fellow infantry battalion is going to be low on water as they march throughout the night through some really crappy terrain. Like, I know that. The log stat is there to help me, you know, check or hold my assumption base going through there. Or like Red Falcons needing a whole bunch of anti-tank weapons, being in contact all day with T-90s. Like, I know they're burning through that. So, you know, really understanding that commander-to-commander dialogue helps shape the ground tactical plan. And you use that log stat suscop as an azimuth check in your back pocket. So kind of leave it with those four.
Thank you very much, sir. And I'll just move it over to Sergeant Major.
Really, I got about two things, right? So AR, everything, right? The power of an AR, if done correctly, is super, super powerful. You know, that's the only way we get better, especially as NCOs. And then as a CSM, when I was out there doing my BFCs, you know, I would leave with something and then come back with something, whether it was commodities, intel, lessons learned. You know, you always want to leave with something and come back. So never go anywhere empty. And then just having cross-training your paratroopers, your soldiers, to be multifunctional, right? You could be a mechanic one day or a fueler the next day, right? Just that power of being multifunctional, whether it's at the ADAG or somewhere else, is super huge.
Thanks, Sergeant Major. And then Zach, to close it up.
Yeah. So as I was mentioning earlier, with, like, you know, the biggest challenge for Army sustainment, you know, is time. Is really just, you know, taking the time up front to develop, you know, a detailed operation so that, you know, as you transition into the execution, like, you know, you have that time saved and can, you know, rapidly execute instead of, you know, trying to develop the plan on the fly.
So one last question is, you know, what advice do you have for the sustainment community then?
Zach, you want to go first?
Yes, sir, I can take that. The advice I'd have is just the importance of sets and reps. So as you know, Sergeant Major was talking about earlier in the podcast, regularly scheduled training, just ensures that personnel are not only familiar, with the tasks that they need to perform, but as you go down the line and execute them, later events, you kind of buy back some of that time just, with, people executing them more efficiently, and effectively, underneath, stressful conditions.
Sergeant Major, you can go.
So for me, my perspective is, tactical sustainment. We, as sustainers, we do our job in garrison all the time, but we can't forget those tactical, foundation that we all have as soldiers. And, for our NCOs here in Gold, right, Talon Forge, and bringing all the NCOs together for a 3-day event is super, super huge, and beneficial. That's all I got.
And then I'll leave you with this, right? So our responsibility, right, in tactical sustainment, right? The phrases that we tell our maneuver brothers and sisters before the fight starts is like, I'll be there, I got you, et cetera. Those are not catchy terms, right? That is trust that we will do our job, right? Tactical sustainers, like we share a heavy burden for our brigade combat team. There is a lot on our shoulders, right? Maintaining and sustaining the flot is our responsibility, right? If we fail to do that, we're putting our brothers and sisters' lives at severe risk and either, total mission failure within days, right? So that is a hefty responsibility and that is why we need to train hard and lead well, right? I'll tell you, the best compliment as a tactical sustainer that you can get from maneuver is when they come back from a rotation, training exercise, or an actual fight, and they tell you, they had everything they needed. Right, that is a good day for us. So, lot to weigh there. But I know, in the tactical sustainment world down here on the flot, down here in our dens, we take it seriously. Thanks.
Thank you all very much for all your wisdom, because I know you all have such just a wealth of knowledge, years of experience. So thank you all for that. This has been a very interesting conversation today. I mean, having not been part of such operation as myself. I know I've personally learned a lot, and that's what's so great about having a forum like this. It just provides listeners who are unfamiliar with the topic to learn about it from subject matter experts like yourselves and gain an understanding that they can later apply in their career. And I know there's probably a lot of questions out there still on some follow-up questions when it comes to JFE and the sustainment there. So where can people find you at if they do have additional follow-up questions?
Yep. So you can find me in Global, not going anywhere anytime soon. But again, free to come down here to Arden Street and we'll definitely host anybody if they want to learn about the JFE and sustainment. Thanks.
Sergeant Major.
Same thing. I'm on globalluis.r.cologne1. Same thing. Come down Arden anytime.
Zach.
Same thing on Global. And yeah, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out.
So I just want to thank you all for taking time to meet with me virtually. So that we can provide our audience with just so much wisdom. This has truly been a fun episode. Just want to thank you all again.
Thanks, Garrett. Appreciate it.
Everyone all the way.
If there has ever been a topic that you want us to discuss, then please reach out to me. I love receiving all your feedback and continue to work every day to provide you with the absolute best product we can for your toolkit. Please continue to share these episodes with your formation and give us a follow and a review. But that is all we have today, folks. As always, sustainment leaders start here. See you next time. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Logstat. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please share this episode across your formation and leave us a review. If you have a topic you like here discussed, then please reach out to us at armysustainment@army.mil or directly to me on Global at garrett.h.pyle. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn at Army Sustainment. We'll see you next time. Sustainment leaders start here.